I think we have some new faces today as well. First timers? Yes. Welcome. It's always jolly good when you have first timers. You can go back to basics. And it's nothing more valuable, more worth than just running over the basics from time to time. It's really, really, really useful stuff. Today I thought we should talk about insanity. You know what insanity is? When you go a little bit crazy? Know someone like that? If you don't, ask someone who you live with. They'll point at someone. Or maybe ask the person sat next to you if you're known to them. We should talk about insanity. Remember the things that we put on the board last week? These emotions that take place in the mind. I put a list down with your help. Do you remember some of them? Fear, anger, frustration, disappointment, expectations, these things. A normal mind does not experience these things. That's all right, quite all right. Let's use this opportunity so that everyone can check their phones. If you've brought them with you, just to make sure it's on silent. You don't have to switch it off if you're sure that it's on silent. All right. So a normal mind, a mind when it's in a normal state, you know, just normal, does not experience all those emotions. So when you feel those things, it's pretty abnormal for a mind. But if you ask modern psychologists, just about anyone, they'll tell you that these are pretty normal things. It's pretty normal to be angry. They'll tell you that it is. It's pretty normal to feel jealousy. It's pretty normal to have desire and to be frustrated, disappointed. And these things will come and go from time to time. Well, when the problem's not yours, everyone's a philosopher, right? But when it's you who's suffering, do you feel very normal? When you are in a fit of rage, when you're really angry about something, really annoyed about something, and you wish that you didn't feel that way, even when jealousy strikes you. You know, those times, they don't feel normal at all. You feel very uncomfortable. And that's when people try and do things to get themselves out of that. You've seen how people, when they get angry, they behave. Sometimes you might have been on the receiving end of that treatment. Sometimes you might have been the one who got angry. Either way, you know that when you have these emotions, it really brings out a dark side of you. A side that you wish you never have to deal with. And I'm sure the other people who live with you also wish the same. They wish they never have to deal with that. Then you don't get to be the best mother, the best father that you'd like to be. You don't get to show affection and love and all the nice and lovely and wonderful things that you are able to share with yourself as well as the people you live with. You don't get to show any of that. You just become a menace to the people you live around, and you also become one to yourself. So as much as people think that this is all normal, the Buddha says none of these are normal emotions. They're all very abnormal. So if it's abnormal, then we need to do something about it. So I thought we should spend today trying to figure out why we end up in such situations, why the mind gets to that point. It's kind of the mind is up here when it's feeling quite generous and charitable and kind and soft-hearted and, you know, all these lovely and good things. It's feeling wholesome. The mind is up here, but once you start feeling anger, it begins to stoop. And then it sometimes goes to such a low level. And then you do things you regret. You know these are not things that you enjoy, because once you come out of this state of mind, you go back to regretting. And then you are remorseful. And then you wonder why that ever happened to you. But then it's too late, isn't it? What has been said. What has been done. And now there's no way to pull any of that back. There's no way to withdraw any of that. The said word causes its damage the moment it is said. Anyone here experience that? Things you've said, on hindsight you thought, I shouldn't have said that? Yeah. So the Dhamma has answers to these problems. And I'm going to try and share some of those answers with you, so that you never have to find yourself in that situation again. Does that sound good? That's what we're here for then. So before we do that then, now you know what today's going to be about. Unless I of course start. You know what I'm like. Useless. Hopeless. Unless I start digressing. So keep me on track. We should be able to cover pretty much the basics at the very least, to figure out why we end up in these miserable states of mind and how and what we can do to not get ourselves in those situations again. Okay, so before we do that, let us all take a moment to bring our palms in veneration of the Magnificent One, the Undefeated One, the Unvanquished One, He whose compassion is unparalleled, He whose wisdom is limitless, He whose compassion is boundless. It is to His holy name we make this veneration, and as we do so, let us also remind ourselves that we renew our pledge of allegiance to the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and we make it our life's purpose to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana and to help others achieve the same along the way.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
So for those who were not here last week, I'm just going to put those things up on the board again. So we know to which problems today we are going to be looking for answers. Okay? You can help me, as you did last week, in case I've forgotten some of them. I'll put down what I remember. We had anger. Anxiety, yes, there was anxiety. Frustration, yes. Disappointment. I can never remember if this is double S or double P. Double? Double S. Thank you. Ah, see? Like that? Just one P. Let's put the sermon to a side and discuss this. It's double S, one P, isn't it? So was I right earlier? One S, one P, okay. Like this. Two what? Can't be bothered. Trust you to check my spelling. One is? Two P's, okay. That one. Next. What else did we have on the board? The? Sorrow, yes, we did have sorrow, yes. Hope, we had hope, yes, we had hope. Envy, jealousy. We did that. Let's not go there again. What was it?
Fear.
Fear. Yep. Oh, there was another one I meant to write, but I didn't. Grief. Regret. Can you see if I write down here? Can you still see from the back? No, it's right. Regret, rejection. Okay, I think that will do. If you've done one, you've done the lot. That's the way it works, anyway. I just want to put them up on here so you have hope. I mean, not this hope. You have hope that your problems will be answered. These are the problems that bother you, aren't they? Sure, yes. Careful with it. These are the problems that bother you. When you have one of these, it keeps you up at night, doesn't it? Yeah? Let's be honest. Because what we are here for is to find answers to the practical problems in life. Not the theoretical problems. The practical problems in life. A day without one of these is a day of bliss. Simple as that. What's a happy day for you? What does a happy day for you look like? Is it not a day where you don't have any of these? Yeah? If you have a happy hour, in that hour you've spent without one of these. Then a minute that is spent without one of these is a happy minute. Second, same thing. So then you come down to chittas, an individual chitta, because that is the shortest measure of time, an individual chitta. An individual chitta, a chitta that does not have one of these, is a happy chitta. A happy chitta is a chitta that has attained Nibbana. There's another one that I'd like to get on here. I'll put it just on this side. Pleasure. It's a tricky one, that one. Because it's an enemy in disguise. You know, the Buddha said on one occasion, if not for these things, people wouldn't strive to attain Nibbana. They wouldn't strive for Nibbana. But then, in the same breath, he also said this. It is because of this, people don't. Let me say that again. If not for this, people wouldn't strive for Nibbana. This is why you and I, all of us, are here. Because you know these are the problems that bother you. In fact, if life was fully, all you experience in life was pleasure. And pure pleasure. I'm talking about pure pleasure. Not the kind of pleasure that you know today. What is the kind of pleasure that you know today? Because we've been talking about it. Pleasure that comes from relief, from vexation, right? Yeah? So some of you may have understood the concept, others might be hearing this for the first time. That's okay, we'll go over some of that today as well. So if life was pure pleasure, just the good stuff, just the good pleasure, no vexation, no frustration, no disappointments, none of these things. It's like when you bite into your favorite food, right? Whether it's cheesecake or whether it's whatever you like. I mean, I look at you like, what's your favorite food? Where do we start? Where do we end? Whatever you like, your favorite item of food. When you take that bite, as you bite into it and your tongue just indulges in that taste, you know, that experience of pure pleasure, that is not pure pleasure, mind you, but let's just imagine that pleasurable feeling when you get that. If you just had that feeling without any of the other negative stuff, without any of this stuff, without vexation, I think that's another one I'll get up on here. Without vexation, you won't have any complaints about life. In fact, you won't even come here. The very reason you're here today is because although this is how you would like to be spending your life, there are times when you experience this, there are also times when you have to deal with these things. Yes? If I could find, or if you could find a way to enjoy, to experience just this and none of this, would you still come to the sermons? Would you, honestly? Even if I had a pretty face, you still wouldn't come, would you? No. So you're here because these problems, they bother you. These are the things that keep you up at night. This is the reason why people ultimately they go and commit suicide. In fact, in here you'll find reasons why people sometimes take alcohol. They want to get themselves intoxicated just so that they can forget some of these problems. Some people take it because they enjoy it. Others take it because they just want to drown away their problems in alcohol. Some take drugs because they want to drown themselves in the drug and just forget about the problems. But, of course, they know that once they regain full state of awareness, all those problems are back with them. But, unfortunately, they have no alternative. So, if even for a little while they can forget their problems, and if there's a drug that helps you forget your problems, not completely make them disappear, forget their problems for a while, people become addicted to that. So what if there was a drug that can completely eradicate all those problems entirely, not forget them, but just completely make them disappear, make them vanish? Would you not be addicted to that? Wouldn't you? If there's a drug, and we know people get addicted to drugs and alcohol, and it helps them forget their problems forever, not forever, just for a short period of time. But if there was a drug that can make all those problems disappear for good, see, something death is the answer. Something death makes you forget your problems forever, and that's why they go and off it themselves. But it is hardly the answer. In fact, it is the worst answer you can bring to a problem, because when you die, all you're doing is breaking your body. It doesn't fix the mind. It is so overrated and so underachieving. It does nothing to solve problems. So if there's anyone you know, maybe someone in the family who's ever talked about or mentioned to you, you know, I'm just fed up with life, and they really mean it. You know, some people just say it, you know, just for drama, right? But just to win your sympathy vote, some people say that. And if they do that, you know, just give them your sympathy, because that's all they want. Some people just want a bit of affection. They just want you to show them that, they just want you to show them that you care. And for that, you know, just like children do, they'll cry and then they'll say, I'm going to go hang myself. So don't you be the one saying, prove it. Don't say that. In those moments, you just need to understand that it's just a child speaking. No matter what age they are, they may be grown-ups, maybe adults, but if someone walks up to you and says, I'm fed up with life, I'm just sick and tired of all of this, I'm going to go hang myself one of these days, What they're really saying is, please show me love and affection. That's what they're really saying. Please give me some acknowledgement. Please give me your recognition. That's what they're saying. They just can't bring themselves up to find the words to express themselves. That's all. So if ever you have that, or come across someone like that, then start with something like that. But then there may be those who are actually, they're not looking for just love and affection, but they're really having to deal with these problems. And they know no other way. Sleeping doesn't work because 6 hours later you're up and these problems are back with you. They've tried the bottle and trying to drown themselves in alcohol, but that doesn't work because after a while you're back to a normal state of consciousness. Drugs don't work because once again, even if you're doing the horse drug, right, you're only unconscious and don't know what's going on for a certain number of hours. After that, you're back in proper consciousness. Then the problems are back with you again. And the drugs also, of course, have another detrimental effect on you. Your system gets used to it. And then to drown your problems, you need to keep increasing the dose. And the stronger the dose, the more harmful the effect it has on your body. And then it just becomes a downward spiral. And before you know it, he's a goner. But the reason that most people, actually take that route is because they have some of these problems, folks, and they don't know how to deal with them. In civil society, we are taught to manage these problems. We are taught to manage these problems. If you have anger, there are things called anger management classes. You've heard of them? Been there? No, don't know yet. There's anger therapy. There's therapy for that. So you'll probably have a few counseling sessions with someone. They'll try and help you to deal with anger. But if you ask the question, how can I work on myself so I never get angry again, then they'll tell you we don't have an answer to that. And in fact, they'll tell you anger is one of the emotions. It's a little bit of anger is healthy. They might even say that. Because the mind has to go through that up and down cycle. And that's all natural, that's all normal. But if you spoke to the Buddha, he'd tell you it's not normal. Once you understand how a chitta works, you yourselves will tell me, Swami Nuansa, it doesn't seem sensible for a chitta to get angry. It doesn't seem sensible for a chitta to feel any of these things. So therefore, if you have ever experienced one of these, ladies and gentlemen, and you still haven't found a remedy for that. Now last week we talked about the different paths that you're on. Right? You go about doing various things in life. There are the teachers, the lawyers, the engineers, so. Right? There's all of you there. And so far you've not discovered a problem to these, or rather a solution to these problems. And that is why you're here, in the hope that Swami Nuansa can share with you the answer to these problems. Some might have even taken meditation classes, mindful awareness classes, breathing techniques. These are things that people try these days. I mean, kudos to them for making an effort. You got to give them a pat on the back for that. But it's a pity that despite all of the effort that goes into something like this, and in some companies, they spend quite a bit to hire consultants and then they do wellness programs. If you work in an organization, perhaps you've experienced some of this as well. I remember when I used to work at the bank, those are very stressful workplaces, right? It's always, you've got to be on the ball, little time, a lot of money. So, what comes with that is stress. A lot of people are stressed. And in this day and age, because the world is moving at such a rapid rate and everything has to be done instantly, and there doesn't seem to be an end to our development and all the things that we have to achieve, stress becomes part and parcel of it. So in fact, in today's day and age, when you submit an application or a CV to a new job or for a new job, it's quite likely that they'll expect you to say, I am able to work in high stress environments. Because here's what they don't want you to be saying 6 months down the line, I'm stressed. Because then you're going to take time out from work. This is going on a lot out there. I think you will know better than I do. If any of you work in HR, in your organizations, if any of you are managers who have to deal with your subordinates, you know what this is all about. People are just stressed here, there, everywhere, because you know, life is stressful. At home, you have the problems you have to deal with. Your children stress you out. Your wife stresses you out. Your husband stresses you out. The bills stress you out. Your neighbors stress you out. Anyone have rowdy neighbors? Maybe loud neighbors? They stress you out. You try to get some sleep at night, and that's the day they decide to play music next door. And you try and give them a call, you know, can you like quieten it down a little bit? You try once, try a second time, try a third time, what, you're going to call the police in on them? You can't do that because you have to get along with them. Right? So what do? You either have to pick up and leave, or you just have to settle. Settle for it. And just continue to be stressed. Then you'll have the in-laws, they stress you out. You have your parents, they stress you out. See? Life is just one after the other. Just stresses kept throwing at you. And then at the workplace, again, you stress out because there are deadlines that you have to meet and reports that have to get filed, contracts that have to be signed, customers that have to be kept happy. They are just like you, your customers. They're not an easy bunch to keep happy. So, of course, life is pretty stressful. And then get yourself on the road, driving in this kind of traffic. You know how happy I am that I'm ordained? Give me one reason for that. I don't have to drive. Yes. Isn't that a good enough reason? Why are you still living a lay life? I don't have to worry about keeping ourselves, you know, safe in traffic and all that. I just have to take a back seat. And if I'm feeling tired, I can take a nap. And by the time I wake up, I'm where I need to be. First class, I travel in first class. Always have a chauffeur. Never driven. From the day I got ordained, never driven. I've never sat behind a wheel. Although driving was part of my life when I was a layperson. I had to drive 50 miles up and down every day of the week on some days. Crossing the street. How stressed people are. Going to the shops. Doing business. Buying something. Queuing. At the ATM, don't you feel stressed? Especially after 7, 8 p.m. Aren't you always looking over your shoulder to see who's behind? Yeah, you're always stressed. If you've got some jewelry on you, aren't you stressed if you have to, you know, walk outside? If you have a daughter who's good looking, aren't you stressed as a mother or a father? There you go. You brought your daughter into this world because you wanted to be happy, but today you are more stressed than happy. Because you're always worried, what if someone does something bad to her? What if someone attacks her? What if someone tries to take advantage of her? These are the problems that keep you up at night, folks. If you have a babysitter at home, I don't know if that culture has come to Sri Lanka now, has it? Babysitters? Do we hire babysitters now? Not yet? Have we? In Sri Lanka? Oh, okay. Okay. Well, in most other countries, it's pretty standard. They hire a babysitter or a nanny. And then, how much can you wet them? I'm not saying they're bad, but even if they're good, how do you know? How do you trust someone? And until something bad happens, you're always doubtful. So even if they're a saint, how do you know? When you take your child to school, you're stressed because you don't know who he's going to go and sit next to. Until they get back home, you're stressed. So you see, folks, you just have to deal with these problems day in, day out, but you don't have an answer. Money doesn't bring you an answer to this. The richest man in the world, he also stresses out. The poorest man in the world, he also stresses out. They just stress out because this is not the answer. They haven't found the answer yet. So if you could experience just pleasure and none of these, you wouldn't be here. So the Buddha says, but the reason that people strive for Nibbana and they keep trying for Nibbana in the ways that they know, it's because these problems, they haunt them. So what we're going to try and work out today is, first of all, find the cause for this. Because that is the method that the Buddha teaches us to deal with any problem, isn't it? If you don't like something, if you don't want something, what do you got to do? Don't deal with the thing that you don't like. Deal with the causes that result in that. Let the effect be. Deal with the causes. Once you've dealt with the causes, the effect will be dealt with. You don't have to do anything about it. So, here's the best part of this. These things you don't have to do anything about. So you don't need to manage your anger, because anger is not the cause of anger. Anger is the result. We don't deal with the results. We deal with the causes. A very simple example. When you want to put out a fire, what do you do? What do you take out? Causes. That's why you throw a blanket over it. Right? Say you have a fire in the kitchen. You throw a blanket over it. Sometimes you throw water at it. Right? If it's maybe an electrical fire, you might put carbon dioxide and use that as an extinguisher. So to extinguish the fire, all you do is actually you take out one of the causes. You don't have to take out all of the causes either. That's also great news. You don't have to take out all of the causes. You just need to take out one of the causes. Because although all the causes are required to manifest a result, to stop it from manifesting, you just need to take out one cause. Don't you like the sound of that? What if to take out something, you have to take out all of the causes? Then you'd have a lot of work to do. But fortunately, to take out something, to extinguish something, you just need to take out one of the causes. Do you all understand what I'm saying there? Yeah, to light a fire, you need oxygen, you need a flammable substance or fuel, and you need temperature. Yeah, so you need to provide all these three to light a fire. But to extinguish the fire, you don't need to take out all these three. You just need to take out any one of these three. Take out any one of these three and the fire is out. In the same way, these are what the Buddha referred to as the 11 great fires. I've not put down all 11 here, but these are examples of that. These are the fires that burn you from within. It's all in here. So if this is a fire, then there's a cause that results in this fire. In fact, there could be multiple causes that result in this fire. But to put it out, you just need to identify one cause. Identify one cause that we can actually deal with, and the fire will be put out. That's a promise. This is where the Buddha comes into this world and teaches us what the cause is for these things, these mental emotions, these frustrations, these agonies that we have to deal with, so that once we identify that cause, we can work on removing that cause. So now I'm going to explain to you, ladies and gentlemen, how they come into being. Because as you understand that, you will understand the causes that lead to this effect. Right, let's do that then. I'm going to take them out. Because as I said, deal with one and you've dealt with all of them. I mentioned the word insanity. Right at the start of the talk. Sabbe putujjana ummattaka. Any idea what that means? Sabbe is all. Putujjana, what do you think that means? Prutakjanas. A prutakjana or a putujjana in Pali is someone who has not yet understood the Dhamma. Means at least someone who has not at the very least attain the state of Sotapanna. So someone who is not at least a Sotapanna, the Buddha refers to them as a Prutukjana. Are they terrible people? No, they're not terrible people, they're just Prutukjanas. A Prutukjana is one who has not understood the Dhamma, simple as that. But here's what he says after that. Sabbe Prutukjana Ummattaka. What is to be Ummattaka? Crazy. Insane. Right, so Sotapannas in the house, please. You're probably being modest, aren't you? Who knows? There may be a few here. Who knows? Because you can't tell a Sotapanna by looking at their faces. There may be a few here. It's quite possible. If you are practicing the Dhamma, if you're listening to the Dhamma, right, there may be a few here. It's quite possible. But if you're still very new to this, if you're still very new to the Dhamma, and you can't become a Sotapanna by listening to anything other than the Buddha's teaching, that's just not possible. And it's not because the Buddha taught it, it's because that is the truth. Okay? And it has to be through listening. You can't read the Tripitaka and become a Sotapanna. It has to be by listening. That is why, while you still have your faculties working, make sure you make use of that. Because once you're deaf, there is no hope for you. You can no longer become a Sotapanna. So protect your ears. Young people in the audience particularly, what have you always got in your ears these days? Your music. Yes? And without you knowing it, sometimes you turn it up, right? And that is deafening. Over time, if you just keep yourselves exposed to that loud music, right? After a while, your ears become useless. You are not able to listen to things. And then, even if later in life, you know, as a young person, you are more interested perhaps, you know, in enjoying yourself and earning money and getting your education and enjoying sensuality, being with friends and all that, partying, whatnot, right? But later on in life, say when you're 70, you think, right, now is the time to attain Nibbana. But then by that point, your ears are no longer audible. You can't hear it. You can't hear things with your ears anymore. And then what's the point? You can't become a Sotapanna. So please protect your ears. Let's just say there's a bomb blast out there. Normally, what do people do? They cover their eyes, don't they? What do you think you should do? Cover your ears. These are the most important organs of your body, your ears. Because it is through your ears you can listen to the Dhamma, and it's only through listening to the Dhamma can you become a Sotapanna. You don't need to be able to see things. You don't need to. It'll help for you to get your things done, go places, go to the temple, if you can see, but someone can walk you there, but someone cannot attain Nibbana by listening to the Dhamma on your behalf. So, Sabbe Putujjana Ummattaka. This can be your slogan. I mean, it speaks about you, so why not? Here's what the Buddha had to say about you. If you are a Prutakjana, in the Buddha's words, he says, you're crazy. I know Swaminand says, it's not the first time I heard that. Why does he say you're crazy? Why does he say you are insane? Let's try and work that out. And once you understand what he means by that, you can then find a path out of this insanity. In fact, the reason you go through all those things I put up on the board earlier is because you are insane. In fact, once the mind goes insane, the mind now becomes susceptible and vulnerable to all those emotions that I put up on the board. If the mind can be sane, can remain sane, and not go crazy, the mind doesn't experience any of those things. The mind is in a state of eternal bliss. Have you seen crazy people? I'm not talking about in the mirror, but have you seen crazy people? Do you maybe know some one or two people? Right? If you don't, you can go to Angoda. There are people there. Right? So people in mental asylums, they've gone crazy. Yeah. I'm not mocking them. I'm just saying, you know, it's a sorry state to be in. But unfortunately, that's what's happened to them. Generally, when someone goes insane, What do you think triggers that? When they're really happy? Is that what causes someone to go insane? When they're really, really, really happy about something? Is it? No. It's usually when they cannot bear the frustrations and the disappointments that come to them in life. There are plenty of mothers who've gone insane at the death of their children. This is one reason why some people go insane. When their loved ones die, perhaps in an accident, and you just discover, you know, you regain your consciousness, and the doctor comes and says, I'm sorry to say, but the rest of your family didn't survive, right? Sometimes the first thing you'll hear is them screaming at the top of their voices. After a while, maybe a few days later even, they try to cope themselves with that situation, but if they can't, then they can go insane. It's quite possible. Some people go insane because of relationship breakdowns. I've seen people like that. People, you know, they just lose it. When a loved one either cheats on them or breaks up and they just can't deal with that, people go insane. And then they say, well, you know, how evil of the loved one. You know, what society would normally do is they'd point their finger at the person that left the other person behind, who broke up with the person, and say, it's your fault that this guy's gone insane. I disagree. It's not their fault. Whose fault is it? It's your own fault. It's your own fault for not having understood the Dhamma. No one else is responsible for that. So let's say, you know, your child is in a relationship right now. Say your daughter's in a relationship with a boy. Okay? And later on, she finds out that he's a cheater. And then she goes insane. You as the father, I ask you, what are you going to do now? Find yourself a rifle? Find out where he lives? And go and teach him a lesson he's never going to forget? Do you think that's responsible? No, because you were already irresponsible once. By doing what? By doing what? Or rather, by not doing what? By not teaching your children the Dhamma. That is why your daughter went insane. Not the boy's fault. So let's take responsibility for our actions and our inactions. Because that's when we can work on ourselves and fix ourselves. Sabbe putuk jana unmattakade. How does that happen? I'm going to talk to you. We talked about this a while back, but I'll go back to basics and just remind you how a chitta is born. A nascent chitta, a chitta when it's born, I'm not talking about a newborn child. I'm talking about a newborn chitta. Where do these things happen? They happen in you right now. Each chitta is a new chitta. First of all, let's understand how a chitta is born. We've talked about this before, so this is going to be a refresher for those who've heard me say this before. The simplest example is you have an eye that comes into contact with an object. As a result of that, you have what we call eye consciousness. Eye consciousness. Eye consciousness is basically a chitta. The reason I draw it as a sine curve is just to represent the fact that it arises and passes away. It does not take this shape because the chitta does not have a shape. The chitta does not have a shape. It does not have a weight. It does not have anything like that. It's an energy. It's a pulse of energy. So a pulse of energy would be something that would do something like this. It's a pulse. So you have arising and passing away. I've just represented that using this graph. When the eye comes into contact with an object, a sight object we call it, we have an eye consciousness. Now, it doesn't stop here, ladies and gentlemen. Because remember, it's not the eye that wishes to see. Then who wishes to see? The mind wishes to see. So it's not enough merely to see a sight. The mind now has to process that. to do what it wants with it. Remember, the eye is merely a faculty for the mind to understand the world and to make sense of the world and ultimately to achieve happiness. That's what we're all here for. That's what the mind wants, to achieve happiness. So when you open your eye and we present an object to it, the eye begins to work on behalf of the mind. On behalf of the mind. So really, this is a slave to the mind. That's why once the mind is tamed and the mind no longer seeks sight, you will no longer have eyes. That's why an arahant is not born. An arahant isn't born because sight is not a faculty that is not any longer required. Sound is not a faculty that is any longer required, because they don't seek pleasure from that. They don't seek happiness from that. But for the time being, you and I, we still open our eyes to see things because our mind wishes to see. And it's not just seeing that the mind wants. The mind wishes to see in a certain way. But sight itself is not able to give that. I'll give you an example. What do you understand about the concept of beauty? Just take a moment to think about this. I'm going to be asking you a few questions today. These are rhetoric questions. So the answers, you need to start thinking in your own minds. Right? Let's get the cogs turning. What do you understand about the concept of beauty? To get you start thinking about it, let me throw you this question as well. Is what you find beautiful, beautiful for everyone? Is it? No. Haven't there been plenty of occasions where you've admired something and you said, wow, that's fantastic, look at it, it's beautiful, isn't it? And someone might have said, what? I've never seen something so ugly in my life. I mean, you laugh about it now, but let me remind you that you are glad that that is so. Because if everyone found your wife or your spouse or your to-be spouse as beautiful and as good-looking as you did, life would be very difficult, wouldn't it? So it's good that not everyone agrees with you, that she is the epitome of beauty. It's only, that's why they say beauty is but skin deep, right? Or it lies in the eyes of the beholder. These are expressions that actually mean something. But the truth is, it's not something that lies in the eyes of the beholder. Beauty actually lies in the mind of the beholder. My point is this here, though. It's not just to remind you of a popular quote. It's actually to share with you this idea that if beauty is not in a sight. Now, I want you to pay attention to this statement. Try and understand what I'm trying to get across to you. If beauty is not in the sight, and if beauty is in the mind, then the eye alone cannot see beauty, can it? Because it's not in the sight. I'll say that again. If beauty is not in the sight, and it's in the mind, then eye consciousness alone. So eye consciousness is basically how the mind sees a sight, not how the mind sees a sight, but let's just say this is the first step to seeing, and the mind has not done any processing of it yet. It's just raw fact, raw data. So the eye has gone to work to capture an image that's on the outside. It's now taken an impression, like a photograph. You know, like those days we had to process photos. Are you that old? Remember that? I was there when it happened. But I'm sure there are those in the audience, you know, you don't have no idea what this means. Maybe especially young people. Back in those days we had reels, right? So you had to take it to the studio where they used to process it. And then you got your still images sometimes a week later. Because they took their time to process those images. In the same manner, so you see, the reel itself is no good to you, is it? When you take, if you remember those cameras, the reel itself, or the image that gets captured on the reel is no good to you. You want the processed image. So the processed image comes out of the studio. It doesn't come out of the camera. In the same way, just about the same way, something goes on here. The eye simply captures raw data. It just captures raw data. Beauty is not raw data. It's processed data. The eye cannot process it. The eye simply captures raw data and then it pumps it all into the mind. It's the mind's job to then interpret all that raw data and, if it wishes, see it as beautiful or see it as ugly or maybe neither, here nor there. This is all to do with the mind. So the relevance of that here is eye consciousness simply captures raw data. So what that must tell you is there's a process that happens subsequently. Immediately after eye consciousness takes place, we call this chakku vijnana in the Pali. Immediately after chakku vijnana or eye consciousness takes place, now it's time for the mind to step in. I'm going to draw the mind as a box. What shape is the mind? It has no shape. So I'm just going to draw it as a box just to represent that there's the mind into which now we have to feed the eye consciousness. Okay? What I'm trying to explain to you, ladies and gentlemen, is what you never learnt at school. But this is what you've been going through all your life and for the remainder of your life. It's also what's going to happen to you after you're dead. This is what happened to you before you were born in this birth in your previous life. This is you. But we hardly ever get to learn these things. We learn about how to send a man to the moon, but we don't understand how the mind of the man works and why they feel fear as they step into the rocket. These things we don't know. But you are now learning these things. So, therefore, you can free yourself from those emotions that I put on the board up earlier and live a happy life. Back to the drawing board. Where did that come from? Eye consciousness then. So you have the eye consciousness. Now, the eye has supported this, the capturing of the sight. We call that the eye consciousness. The next task to do is to drop that object onto the mind. Once it's in the mind, now there's a process that takes place. In fact, there's a lot that starts to go on in the mind. It's like when you eat something. You just put something into your mouth, but the whole digestion process, there's a lot to it. You've got to churn your food, you've got to break it up, you've got to digest it, you've got to throw acid at it, you've got to throw bile at it, right? You've got to do all sorts of things to digest that food and get the nutrients out of it. In the same way, this is just raw data. Once it hits the mind, there's a lengthy process. It actually doesn't take very long at all, although I call it a lengthy process. It's a fairly complex process that happens at the flash of a second. In fact, the time it takes me to do this, it's happened within you about a billion times. That's how fast your minds work. All this. It's happened about a billion times. That's how fast the mind works. Because it's just energy. You don't have to move physically, you know, things physically here and there. You know the speed of light and how fast light is? Yeah, that's energy. So, physicists today say that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. That is the fastest that something can travel. Okay. Let's assume that is true. Now the mind also then can travel at the speed of light. Some 330,000 kilometers per second. Kilometers or meters? 330,000 meters or kilometers? Come on. Meters, right? Meters? Meters or kilometers? Students in the class, help me out. Miles. 330,000. Miles, is it, sir? I thought it was meters or kilometers. Miles. Okay, whichever. So it travels at the speed of light. That's homework for me. I'll go check. I'll let you know next week, all right? So it travels at the speed of light. Let's assume that that is true. Let's assume that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, because that is energy. So the mind is also energy then. If the mind is also energy, then the mind must travel at least at that speed. So then we have the mind. Now it's just receiving this object that has been dropped, having been received by eye consciousness. And now we have a process that's going to go in here. I'm now going to explain to you what happens inside this box. Understanding this is vital to understanding what causes all those mental agonies and grief and frustration and vexation and anger and all that. Because all that happens here. None of it happens here. None of it. None of it happens here. So therefore your eyes are never responsible for your ups and downs. When you have your mood swings, when you're feeling good, when you're feeling bad, your eye is not responsible for that. Your eye consciousness is not responsible for that. Well, here's the point I want to try and make as well while we're here at this junction. If the eye is not responsible for that, do you think the sight is responsible for that? If the eye is not responsible for it, then is it even possible that the sight could be responsible for it? No. Then whenever you have those emotions, do you think it's right to find answers in changing the outside world objects or people or the situations or the circumstances? Absolutely not. Because the eye is not responsible for your mental pains. It does not take part in that process. All of it happens here in the mind. Right, now let's take a dip into it and work out what goes on in there. We're trying to work out how insanity happens. Now we're in the mind. This is that box I drew earlier. Okay? A sight object has just been dropped on it. And now the mind's turn it is to process it. The mind wishes to see beauty. Don't you like to see beautiful things? Pretty things, lovely things. You like to see them, right? It's not the eye that wants to see that, it's the mind. Let's try and figure out how it is that you see this beauty. Because you know that beauty does not exist in the object. Something that does not exist in the object, in other words, something that is not objective, if you can see that when you look at a sight, when you look at something, then something must be going on within you. That's simple logic, I think. I think everyone will agree with me on that. If beauty is not in the object, and you still see beauty when you look at an object, it cannot be something to do with the object. It cannot be something to do with the physical eye. Something must be going on in the mind for you to perceive something as beautiful. Are you all in agreement with me on that? Because we need to take this step by step. Right? Okay. So now let's work out how it is you see beauty. Views. In the Pali we call it drushti. In Sinhalese we call it, no actually in Sanskrit you call it drushti, in Pali we call it ditti, and in Sinhala we call it, it doesn't matter how we call it in Sinhalese, dakma. Okay, so we call them views. I'm going to call this ditti. Oh, drushti. I'm going to use one of these two words because views just doesn't roll off the tongue for the simple reason. Okay? But you've heard this before. Right view in the Noble Eightfold Path. Right, right view, right consciousness, right action and so on, right livelihood. So right views is the first item that features in the Noble Eightfold Path. So if there's a right view, there has to be a what view? A wrong view. Because to get yourself onto the Noble Path means, initially, you come to right view. So then therefore, one who's not on the Noble Path, in other words, one who is a Pratakjana, is then in what view? Wrong view. That is what we call Michchaditti. So views are twofold. You have sammāditti and you have micchāditti. Right views and wrong views. What is an example of a right? No, let's take an example of a... Okay, what's an example of a right view? Which political party should win the next election? Right view? What's the right view? Which party? Nothing to do with that. You know, this right view, wrong view that I'm about to talk to you about, you can only hear in the Buddha Sasana. You will never hear it anywhere else. If you ask me what this is, and if I told you this is an elephant, that is also a wrong view. But it has nothing to do with your suffering. Once again, if I asked you what this was, or you asked me what this is, and I told you this is anything but a pen, and I actually believe that it is anything but a pen, then I'm in a wrong view. If I tell you this is a pen, that is a right view. But that kind of view has nothing to do with your suffering. Nothing. Of course, if you don't know what an elephant is, that could give you some suffering physically, because you might bump into one and think that's a pen, and that could happen. But I'm not talking about that kind of suffering. I'm talking about the mental suffering. You know, the stuff I put on the board earlier. Those things have nothing to do with that kind of view. But tell me though, when we go to school, at school, when we take education, right, when we teach ourselves or we take lessons, we learn a lot about the world, don't we? We learn math, we learn science, we learn sociology, we learn geography, we learn about the stars, the planets, the moons, right? We learn about the earth, we learn about a lot of things. We learn about water, clean water, dirty water, how we should use one but not the other, and so on, right? These are also views. This is also drishti. Our teachers give us drishti. They instill drishti within us. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, that kind of drishti does not help with your mental problems. It only helps with your physical problems. What is proof of this? Last week's discussion that we had. In this audience will be professors. In this audience will be teachers. Will be people who have achieved the pinnacle of their careers in many and almost every aspect and walk of life. But yet, you're still angry. You still get disappointed. You still feel jealousy. You still burn with desire. So therefore, that drishti has done nothing to save you from the mental vexations that go on in you. That's why I say, the drishti that I speak of from here on is not the drishti that you took from school. You never got this drishti from school. Maybe at school you learned who the Prince Siddhartha's father was and you learned that he was King Suddhodana. That is also a drishti, but that drishti does not help you to free yourself from suffering. Knowing that Siddhartha the Bodhisattva went on to become Gautama the Buddha is simply a fact. It's a knowledge, it's a piece of knowledge. It's also a drishti, but that drishti helps you pass your exams. It doesn't help you free yourself from anger. Did it? There you go. So there are two kinds of drishti in this world beside this categories. Drishti can also be... So this is one dichotomy, there's another. There's worldly. Worldly drishti. What shall we call the other one? Supramundane, or we call it mundane. Easier to contrast. This is mundane and this is supramundane. Two kinds of drishti. This is another way to categorize them. Worldly drishti or mundane drishti is what we learn at school. How do you cross the street? Do you check left first, right first? How do you tie your shoelaces? These are all drishti, right? To learn to put your books in your bag, to learn to do your homework, to learn to be on time, to learn to be polite, to learn to be courteous. These are all drishti. But this is all worldly stuff. mundane stuff. It helps you to live a convenient and comfortable life, granted, but it doesn't help you free yourselves from suffering. For that, you need the supramundane stuff. You don't get it from anywhere other than the Buddha Sasana. That's why you're in the right place. For all the years that you've taken education, you never tried this. You only tried the other. That's why you're still suffering. So now that we are starting to do this, do we have to stop doing that? Do we have to stop doing this stuff? No. You carry on acquiring mundane knowledge because it is important. It's necessary. When I need a robe, right? When this robe is torn and I need to replace my robe, do you think supramundane knowledge is going to help me with that? Of course not. I'll have to learn how to sew a robe. Or someone who knows how to do one will have to offer one to me. So we can't live in this world if we didn't have the mundane stuff. We need the mundane stuff. My point is that, not that it's not important. It's not that we can just diss all that and just forget all that. That's not what I'm saying. We need that. But it doesn't help answer the mental problems that we have. It makes our life livable. It makes our lives convenient and comfortable. But if you want to free yourself from suffering, now you need the supramundane knowledge. Make sense? Right. When we come to supramundane views, there's again right views and wrong views. There's right views and wrong views. Here's one of the supramundane category type wrong views. I'm going to give one to you. This is one you've always held as true in your life. And this is why you always suffered. When you look at your child's face, don't you think he or she is pretty? Cute, handsome, wonderful, lovely, darling. You do, right? That is supramundane type wrong view. In other words, your belief that beauty exists in the world outside, that brings you suffering. It brings you suffering, and I'm going to prove that to you. It brings you suffering. As much as you feel that that is what you live for, as much as you feel that without beauty, what is the point of living at all? Isn't beauty what we all need? It brings you suffering, ladies and gentlemen. Now, just a moment ago, I asked you about your favorite type of food. Everyone in the audience will have an answer to this. Well, most everyone, let's just say. Right? If there's one who doesn't, then that's you. Everybody else has. Everyone, pretty much everyone has an answer to this. What is your favorite item of food? And if I asked you why, you will tell me because it's delicious. It's delectable, you'll say. You love it. But then not everyone in the world likes it. Sometimes, you know, people at home, people who live with you, you're the only one who likes it. And when you do your weekly shopping, some things that you have at home are only bought because you like them. Nobody else does. Parents, don't you have things like that at home? Maybe if the wife goes shopping, she'll have to fetch something for the husband. Nobody else at home has it, but he does. So we have to get it. Or maybe the elder son does, and so therefore we have to get it. Maybe the younger son does, and therefore we have to get it. Maybe the mother does, and so therefore we have to get it. This is for Amma, this is for Tata, this is for Chutimali, this is for Lokamali, this is for Akki, this is for Nangi. Nobody else likes it. In fact, some maybe even despise it, but there are those who like it. Isn't that again evidence that this deliciousness that you experience when you eat something, when something touches the tip of your tongue, it is not in the object? I don't mean the taste of the food. I mean the deliciousness of the food. They're two different things. Sweet tastes sweet to everybody. No questions about that. Even to the arahant, if you give the arahant some sugar and put it on the tip of their tongue, the arahant is going to feel sweetness in just the same way that you and I do. No difference in that. That is to do with, just like we have the eye consciousness, there's also something called the tongue consciousness. That sweetness is to do with tongue consciousness. But if I asked you which is your preferred taste, what taste do you like more than others? You might have an answer to that question. You'll say, I like sweet, I like sour, I like umami. You have answers to this. But an arahant will not answer that question. Why? Because he doesn't have an answer to that question. Because in his mind, there is no taste that stands out of the rest. Although you find certain tastes delectable, you find certain tastes delicious, an arahant does not experience that. They don't go through that. For an arahant, there is sour, there is bitter, there is sweet, there is all the other bitter and so on. I mentioned bitter, salty taste. They know these tastes exist for an arahant. Whatever the tongue can taste, an arahant can taste. Whatever the eye can see, the arahant can see. Whatever the ear can hear, the arahant can hear. They're not deaf. So you play them a music, you know, your favorite song. You play it for them. Right? They'll tell you, this has a melody. If it has a beat, they'll tell you, this has a beat. It has a rhythm. They'll tell you all that. But then you ask this question from them. So I'm going to say, do you like it? Don't you think it's a lovely song? They'll tell you, there's no such thing called a lovely song. It's a song. It's a song. It has a beat. There's a rhythm. There's a tune. There's a melody. But it's not melodious. It's not pleasing to the ear. He's not going to say that. We say that because something happens in the mind that does not happen at the ear. You go insane. Now let's get to the crux of that. So now you understand that there are two types of drishti, sammaditti and mityaditti. What is mityaditti? At this level, simply expecting that beauty, deliciousness, right, this pleasantness. Not sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Let me get that clear. Not sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. I'm talking about pleasantness. Pleasantness exists in sights, in sounds, in smells, taste and touch. Make sense so far? Okay. But does pleasantness exist in a sight? Objectively, does pleasantness exist in a sight? Are you all in agreement with that? If you are nodding your head, you must know it within your heart. You have to accept this truth. Otherwise, there's no point in us progressing, moving forward. I need all of you, everyone in the audience right now, to confirm that you understand and you accept that beauty is never in an object. It cannot be found in an object. Do you all agree with that? Okay. Do you all agree that music is music, but music cannot be music to your ears? You know, that's an idiom. When someone says, that's music to my ears, what they actually mean is, it's melodious. I like it. It sounds really nice. That is not in the music. Do you all agree with me on that? Because if it was wrong, I mean, if it was so, everyone should experience the same. But that is not right. There are some who like the kind of music that you like. There are some who don't like the kind of music you like. So therefore, it cannot be in the music. Yeah? The same goes for taste. The same goes for smell. When you go to buy a bottle of perfume, you buy one type, maybe your sister buys another type, your brother, your mother, your father, they buy a different type, a different brand, a different fragrance, right? The soap that you have at home, maybe if you like what it smells like, right? Some might like it, some might not like it. Your favorite smell will be one, for someone else it could be something else. So therefore, that pleasantness does not exist in smell. Agreed? All in agreement? Right, let's move forward then. Now, although you have agreed with me that pleasantness does not exist in sight, when you see something pretty, when you see something beautiful, almost intuitively, You feel that it's actually in there, don't you? If I showed you a picture of a beautiful girl, conventionally, if I showed you a picture of a beautiful girl, let's say Aishwarya Rai, everyone okay with that? Or do you want to take a different example? I'm just using that name because she was Miss something something in some time back. So take, is she still alive? I don't know because I don't keep up to date with what's going on in the world out there. She is, yeah? Okay, good for her. So let's take Aishwarya Rai, right? More than half the world agreed that she was the most beautiful woman alive in her heyday. It might still be true, but she won the Miss World. Okay, Miss World back some time ago. So if I showed you a picture of Aishwarya, if I just showed you a picture of Aishwarya, you'd look at her and say, she's very beautiful. We've just discussed, quite briefly at least, that beauty is not in the sight. But when you look at her, you can't help yourself from thinking that beauty is part of her. Don't you agree with me on that? Isn't that why you fall head over heels when you see a pretty person? Huh? Guys? Ladies? Right? When you see someone, like either handsome, we use these words, handsome, pretty, beautiful, and so on. When you look at someone, I'm using someone, it applies to some things as well, but something that we can all relate to. Right? Most people in here will have had a relationship in their lives at some point, or at least found someone to be good looking. Children, you can cover your ears now. If you've ever found someone to be good looking, until you learned what I just explained to you a few moments ago, or somewhere in the Dhamma, it doesn't necessarily have to be here, if you learned it somewhere in the Dhamma, although you know it now as a fact, that beauty is only in the mind, it's a fact. But when you see this sight, inside of you, don't you feel that it's actually out there? So don't you feel that there's a disparity between what you know and what you actually experience? All in agreement with me on that? Are you sure? Yeah? So there's a disparity between what you know and what you actually experience. Now, if you don't agree with me, go home when you get back home tonight. Right? Look at yourself in the mirror and see how beautiful you are. When you look at yourself in the mirror, right, and you do your makeup, whatever, right, you check your, I don't know, acne or your black spots and your whatever you do to make yourselves the picture of beauty, right? Whatever you do, excuse me. When you do that, don't you actually feel that it is you who's beautiful? In those moments, you don't feel like beauty is a process that happens in the mind, do you? You actually feel that beauty is in the object. That's why you say it's a beautiful object, a beautiful person. And most of the time, when it comes to relationships, beauty is generally, you know, good looks is generally the first attraction. Before you actually think of going up to them and talking to them, asking them out, whatever, usually, I mean usually, okay, not always, but usually, you have to first be attracted to their looks. That's when you feel like going up to them and asking them. You think she's cute, you think she's pretty, you think she's, you know, that is what beautiful is. So you want to be with her. These are the emotions that go through your mind. Now you know that as a fact, as a piece of knowledge, you know that beauty cannot be in the object. But just because I've said this doesn't mean the internal experience is going to change. In fact, as I said, go home tonight and check yourself in the mirror. And if you thought you were beautiful before you set forth come to the sermon today, you will feel exactly the same way after you get back home. Although you know it by knowledge that beauty is not in the object, it's not in my face, it's not part of my body, you will still look at yourself in the mirror and think to yourself, I'm still beautiful. This is because the drushti that you had previously, that beauty is in an object, is ingrained in your mind. It is a drishti that has taken seat in your mind and it has been there for such a long time. It has become your de facto method of processing information. It is your modus operandi. You accept, you believe without doubt, without question, that beauty and ugly are actually characteristics of objects. Just as you would say, this pen has a weight. You'd look at your pretty child and say, my child is beautiful. Just as you feel that this pen has a weight and it's a characteristic of this object, it's a defining characteristic of this object, you would say, my wife is beautiful. I am beautiful. This flower is beautiful. Because you can't help yourself from feeling that beauty is actually in the flower. This is how deeply engraved and ingrained your drishti is. It's going to take a while for the right drishti to replace that. But you needn't do it on my account. You only have to start doing it if you realize that it leads you to suffering. So that's what I'm going to try and do now. Let's work out when you know well and truly now, as at least by knowledge, that beauty is not in the object, why do you still sense from within? Why does that voice from within tell you she is beautiful? Let me draw a beautiful girl on the board. Don't laugh. This is a beautiful girl. What, I just drew you, okay? Just be quiet now. This is a beautiful girl. When you look at this girl and you think she's beautiful, although I've just explained to you that beauty is not in the object, you can't help yourself from this internal voice, your mind speaking out and saying, no, beauty is in the body, it's in her, she's beautiful. Beauty is a defining characteristic of this person. Can't you see it? So right now your drishti, the drishti that I've just given you, is fighting with your internal experience. There's a conflict now. Your practice, the practice of the pratipada, what we do in the sasana, is the replacing of the right drishti with the wrong one and to make it your modus operandi, your de facto. Right now, or just before I explain the Dhamma to you, you thought beauty was hers, was part of some, was objective, and therefore you saw beauty, and you had no problem with that. But now, you are beginning to understand that beauty is not in the object, but from within, you still sense that it is in the object, and therefore there is now a conflict. Hopefully, what I'm about to explain to you now will help you on this task that you are on right now, to remove this wrong perception, because the drishti has not stopped at a drishti, it has actually become a perception for you. To remove this wrong perception, to stop you incorrectly perceiving that beauty is in the object. For that, you just need to understand how beauty works, how beauty originates in the mind. And here's how it does. When the mind thinks, by drishti, this is mitya drishti, when the mind thinks that beauty is in an object, ladies and gentlemen, and it is beauty that you wish to see, you set an expectation. I'll slow it down. Let's take it one step at a time. There's no rush here. Because some of these concepts will be very new to many. For some, this is now like the back of your palm. You know this because you are at the monastery on Saturdays, you are here on Sundays, you have become Srila Sravikas, Vaisis and so on. So you know what I'm talking about. But for most of you, this is going to be new. So it's fine. Let's take it one step at a time. So once again, here's what I wanted to say. Until you listen to the Dhamma, the Buddha's teaching, it is your belief that this object, can I refer to her as an object, just for conversation's sake? She has height. Okay, let's say she's 5'6". She has weight. So you say her height, her weight. She is 58 kilos. She has hair on her head. Fact or fiction? Fact. Weight, 58 kilos. Fact or fiction? Fact. Height, 5'6". Fact or fiction? Fact. Okay? She has a pair of eyes. Fact or fiction? Fact. She has a nose. Fact or fiction? Fact or fiction? Fact. In the same way. It's just in the same way. Just like you feel that these are characteristics, defining characteristics of this person. Now here's the next one. She's beautiful. Fact or fiction? No. Forget the Dhamma. just forget the Dhamma that I just explained to you 10 minutes ago. Now what? Fact or fiction? Fact. That's how you perceive it. Until the Dhamma teaches you that it is fiction. I'm liking this sermon today. Thank you. Until the Dhamma proves to you that it is fiction, you believe it's fact. When you were younger, what was Santa? Fact or fiction? Fact. What was Superman? Fact. Now? Fiction. What changed? Sammaditti. Michaditti got replaced by Sammaditti. It's the same thing that I want to happen for you. What is fact? Let's leave it as fact. But right now, there are certain things that are fiction to do with this object. So fiction is only a figment of your own imagination. But because you are ignorant of it, you project that fiction onto this object. And then you believe to yourselves that that fiction is actually fact. Does that make sense to everyone? What I just explained there? Okay. So this girl, now we're all looking at her. And we are feeling this, we have this feeling that she is beautiful. Okay? Right now it's fact. She's beautiful. I'm going to talk you through how beauty occurs in the mind. At the end of that discussion, I want to ask you the question, do you want to keep it as fact or do you want to replace it and put a new label on it and call it fiction? Each to themselves. Okay? Let's just assume we don't know the Dhamma yet. So forget all the Dhamma that you know right now. Right now, beauty is fact. Okay? Okay, you're playing along with me on this one. Right? So right now, beauty is fact. I'm going to explain something to you. And in just a moment, I'm going to ask the question again. Is it still fact or is it fiction? If it's still fact, then so be it. But if you want, you can change your mind at that time and say, no, Swami Nohan, sir, now I realize it's not fact, it's fiction. Well, let's see. Let's work on the current assumption that this is fact. Because we have to work with an object, right? I'm presenting in front of your eye this girl. This is your eye, by the way. This is your eye. I have presented the girl in front of your eye. You see beauty. You say she's beautiful. Yeah? You say she's beautiful. And you think it's fact. Okay. Let's slow this process down. I'm now going to slow this process down. I'm going to time lapse it. Really, really, really slow it down. But when you see the girl, In a flash of a second, you'll tell me, she's a girl and she's beautiful. But that's because there's a lot that's going on. Like I said, there's a billion processes that are going on in the flash of a second. I'm going to slow that down and then walk you through what actually goes on in the mind. And then you try and figure out whether at some point your fiction becomes fact or your fact becomes fiction. Step one. The object is presented to the eye. Remember, this is just a rupa. This is just a sight. Light falls on this. Light falls on this. And light is reflected as it does with any object. And that light hits the eye. Okay? The eye then starts working. The optic nerve picks up a signal. A what signal? This is actually an electrical signal. It's an electrical impulse. An electrical impulse carries the message that has been encrypted by the eye, by the retina, to the brain. Once it hits the brain, now the brain cannot stop there because it's not the brain that wishes to see, is it? What wishes to see? The mind wishes to see. So now the brain has to convey this message to the mind. But the mind doesn't read electrical signals. Therefore, the brain's task it is to translate that electrical impulse to a message that the mind can understand. And this is what we have always been referring to as rupa. Remember the five aggregates? Rupa. This is what we refer to as rupa. This is also rupa. The outside rupa is also rupa. In fact, if you want to call it, you can call it rupa externa. External rupa. You can call this rupa interna. Internal rupa. It's fine. Although this is form of the pure octet, you might have heard of it. Apo tejo vayo dhatu. Apo tejo vayo. Patavi apo tejo vayo. Varna gandha rasa oja. This is the pure octet, and that octet is always together. That's not sidetrack. That's just a bonus piece of information. We don't need to get carried away with that. This is the rupa that we are interested in now. Although, can I ask you this question though, before we proceed? Do you think beauty is in any one of these? Is it in the patavi? In the vayo? In the apo or the tejo? No, beauty is not in any of them. The most you got from the object was actually reflected light rays. Nothing more, nothing less. That's all you got. Reflected light rays. So now, this process, which includes the eye, the brain, and so forth, their task, their collective task, is now to drop a piece of information onto the mind. And this is the mind box. The mind that I'm representing with a box now. And now this rupa is dropped on the mind. Okay, so I'm slowing down, step by step, something that happens so rapidly that what I'm actually explaining to you happens about a billion times in a second, ladies and gentlemen. So therefore, you are never, I tell you this, you are never going to be able to slow this down and experience it for yourself. You're never going to be able to do that. You can be free of suffering. You can understand how the mind works. But here's what you'll never be able to do. See the mind as it works. You're not going to be able to do that. Because it's too fast to actually slow down and see. It's like when you're in traffic, when you're driving up the road, you see a vehicle's road, when the wheel turns so fast, it's almost like it's one rotation, right? In fact, it's like there's something smooth, I don't know, it's an optical illusion. Yeah, the what do you call them, the alloys and what are the parts that connect it to the center? It's not the axle, the spokes. Yeah. So let's imagine a bicycle wheel. The spokes, they all appear to be part of one unit, whereas in fact you have maybe 20, 30 odd spokes that are actually they're individual things, right? But because it turns so fast, at that rate you are never going to be able to count the number of spokes on a wheel. In the same way, you are not going to be able to stop this or look at the chitta, your own chitta, and see how this process works for yourself. Then you might ask me, why are we learning this if we are not never going to be able to see it? It's not because you can't see this as it happens, you suffer. It's because you don't know what's happening that you suffer. That's why. Not because you can't see it, but because you don't know it. They're two different things. This explanation, our effort right now is to try and understand how it works and what goes on, not to actually see it as it happens. I say this to you because when I used to learn Abhidhamma and Dhamma school, someone told me one day that if you practice the path enough and you understand the Dhamma really, really, really well, especially the Abhidhamma, one of these days I'm going to actually be able to see all the chittas as they arise and pass away. And believe you me, I tried. Because they talked to me about the chitta viti. And I was trying to see how all the javanas would arise and pass away. And sampatichana santirna vottapana. Right? I was actually trying to see them. Little did I know that it is not something that we are ever going to be able to see and observe in that manner. We just need to understand it. That's all. Now we are at the box. This whole game starts with you, step one, thinking, believing that beauty is in this object. But beauty is not in the object, and all you are getting from this are the light rays and the rupa. This rupa, we can call it a rupa-rupa if you wish, because rupa-rupa in other words means a rupa that is related to sight. If it's on the tongue, we can call it a rasa-rupa or a taste-rupa, a taste object if you like. This is called a rupa-rupa. Question time. If you followed the process so far, tell me, do you think this rupa has any information about how beautiful this rupa, this object is? What do you think? This rupa, do you think it has any information, any data that says how beautiful this rupa is? Do you think so? No, it doesn't. Why is that? Because it's not here. It's not in the object. Because beauty is in the mind. So therefore it cannot be in the rupa. Remember, this is the eye consciousness we talked about earlier. This is the eye consciousness. So beauty cannot be a message that is conveyed by eye consciousness. Fair enough? Okay. Now we are in the mind. The mind expects beauty to arrive from the object. Because the mind thinks as a fact that beauty is in the object. Now the mind is in a state of expectation. Your mind is in a state of expectation. Because the mind believes, this is what we call the mitya ditti. The mind believes that objects, they have pleasantness, you can call it beauty if you want, pleasure. We can use these terms interchangeably. Okay, so let's just call it beauty for now. Your mind believes that beauty is in the object. So if beauty is in the object, what is the mind expecting to see now? What is the mind expecting to see? Beauty. Let me give you an analogy. You order a takeaway. Let's say you ring up a pizza shop and they say, right, we'll deliver it to you in 15 minutes. Okay? In just about 15 minutes time, the doorbell rings. What do you expect to see when you open the door? The delivery guy with the pizza. I mean, that's fair enough, right? In the same way, because you expect this rupa to bring to you beauty which you believe is in the object, as the mind receives this rupa, it expects to see what? Beauty. Now, anyone in the audience that didn't understand that, please put your hand up. I can go through it again. Because I need all of you to understand this before we take the next step forward. So, you all get it? Fabulous. So, when I give you a chance, don't be modest and don't be silent. Right? Because it's not always I can ask the audience to see if everyone has understood. But I really, really, really want you to understand this. We'll go over it many, many times, but it would be really good if you can all understand this as we make progress. You would want it one more time? Yes. Yes. I'll come back to that point in a bit, madam, okay? It's a good question. It's a very good question. I'll come back to them later. So the question that the lady is asking is, if we ask the audience about Aishwarya Rai, wouldn't most people in the audience put their hand up to say that she's pretty? There may be the odd person who might say, actually, I don't find her all that good looking, but most will generally say, yes, she's very good looking. And the lady is asking, why is that so? Because I just said that, you know, beauty is not the same for everyone. It's only a creation of the mind. So then why is it that there are some things that many people find beautiful? You know, the knuckles falls, right? Many people will say that it's beautiful. That's why you have so many people going there. The Sigiriya, it's an attraction. It's a popular attraction. That's why many people go there. Madame Tussauds, the other day we showed you on screen. It's a popular attraction. Why do many people go there? Not everyone does, but still many people do. I'll come back to that later. It's a very good question. Have you all understood what I explained to you so far? Okay. And do engage with me when I ask you questions. At least give me a nod so I know that you have understood. Remember, I'm not just here to give you a lecture. I want you to get to Nibbana. If it was just me coming here for a lecture, then I'll charge you a fee. You pay me the fee and I don't even care whether you sleep throughout the sermon. As long as I get my money, I go away. I'm not a lecturer. I'm not a lecturer. I'm here because I care about you. I need you to understand this. I absolutely need you to understand this. Because if you can understand this, you will be free from all the things I put on the board earlier. If that is what you want, that is what I want for you. So therefore, do engage with me. When I ask you a question, just give me a nod. If you don't understand it, just go this way. If you do understand it, just go this way. Right? If you are closer up, then I can see your faces. But that's not practical. I mean, I can't ask all of you to come and surround me, sit around me. Right? So, but that's okay. I can see your nods. That's enough. Now, we are in the mind. Remember, at this point, the mind believes, it strongly believes this. There's no reason to question or doubt any of this. The mind believes that beauty is in the object. Therefore, when the rupa, which is the eye consciousness, which is, you can just think of it as a message. The message has now been delivered to the mind of a sight that the eye has seen. The mind is not merely expecting to see a sight. It's expecting to see, gone? A what sight? A pretty sight. It's expecting to see a pretty sight. A beautiful sight. But does this rupa deliver a pretty sight? What does it deliver? Just a sight. It just delivers a sight. Just a sight, not a pretty sight. Now we have a problem. In very simple terms, what is the problem? The mind is expecting one, but the delivery is another. When that happens, let's go back to the analogy. So the pizza guy has arrived. Knock, knock, knock. You open the door. You've ordered pepperoni pizza. They brought you cheese and tomato. What do you do? Whatever Swami wants, as long as it's pizza. You accept it and then complain. Can I have the pepperoni as well? Now, what would you normally do? Normally. Okay, no, not normally. Abnormally, what would you do? You'd say, this is not the pizza I ordered. Right? In fact, you might be disappointed. You might even complain. Like, this is not what I ordered. Please, can you go and get me what I ordered? But in that moment, because you're not happy with your delivery, you become disappointed. You're disappointed. Let's say the driver goes back and they bring another pizza. Now you ordered pepperoni. This time they bring back ham and pineapple. Last time they brought back cheese and tomato. This time they bring you ham and pineapple. What did you order? Pepperoni pizza. I know where you guys are going to be stopping for lunch today. I can hear it. So make sure those refreshments are ready at the end of this sermon. Otherwise, as I come to you with my Pindapatha arms bowl, I'll hear your tummy's rumbling. That's all right. You're forgiven. So this time round they brought you ham and pineapple, but you ordered pepperoni. Again you are disappointed. See, the mind also gets disappointed in the same way. But there's only so many times you can get disappointed before you get annoyed. Aren't I right? Yes. After a few times, you go, hey, what's going on? Like, this is like the third time I ordered this. Why can't you just get an order right? How many times have I had to send you back and you still got the order wrong? You know, this is really getting annoying. Right? And you get angry. Now, that is an analogy. Let's bring you back to what's going on here. The mind is now expecting the I consciousness to deliver not just the rupa, but a what rupa? A pretty rupa. But what arrives is just a rupa. You know what happens to the mind? It gets annoyed. It gets disappointed. I asked you earlier in the sermon whether you've seen crazy people, people who've gone mad. And then I asked you the question, what do you think caused that to happen to them? Was it just time, an instance where they were really happy about something, or whether it was a time where they were really annoyed about something, or rather, maybe very disappointed, maybe, you know, completely, their hopes were completely lost, lost hopes. And you agree it was the latter. Like, no one went crazy because they were happy. People only go crazy when they are unhappy. Like a mother losing her child. This is one of the things that can cause a mother to go insane. This is exactly what happens in the mind itself. I'm now talking about an individual chitta. When the chitta expects not just a rupa but a pretty rupa, but the I can only deliver a rupa, The chitta's expectations have now been let down. The chitta's been let down. Therefore, now the chitta is disappointed. And when a chitta is disappointed, it starts to do something really weird. When a mother loses her child, have any of you listened to the Baby Natasha sermon? Some nods. Okay. So Baby Natasha was a baby who used to... She was a baby that a mother never had. So once upon a time there was a lady who got pregnant. She was happily married. She got pregnant. And she was expecting a child. What? She was pregnant and expecting a child? That doesn't make sense. It's the same thing. Right? So she was expecting a child. But at the point of delivery, she lost her child. When the doctors informed this lady that she'd lost her child at delivery, she couldn't take it. She couldn't handle that news. And so therefore, she went crazy. When she went crazy, what happened to her was, she started to have these illusions. In other words, she started to hallucinate. And in these hallucinations, she had a child. So she walked out of the maternity ward. She walked out of the hospital carrying an imaginary child. Because there was no real child to carry, but to her, the child was very real. Everyone else around her would question, would wonder, what's this woman doing? Why is she walking like this? With her hands in a funny way, why is she walking like this? And if someone would question her, why are you walking like that? She would ask in return, what do you mean why am I walking like that? I've got my baby with me. Don't you see her? Because she'd gone mad. If ever you've seen a mad person, most mad people, in their minds, ladies and gentlemen, they conjure up, they hallucinate the object that was so close to them and that they desired. But they just couldn't take the shock of losing it. And once the mind is not able to take that shock, because there's a certain level of vexation that the mind can tolerate, but after that point has surpassed, the mind starts to hallucinate and create this imaginary object that is the object of its desire. Have you not seen sometimes people, they talk to these imaginary friends or sometimes to their lost loved ones? Now this might happen maybe with your grandparents if you've seen this. I've seen a few grandparents to whom this has happened. The wife passes away, so the grandmother passes away, and the seer who's at home, he still talks to the wife. People think that he's actually talking to her spirit, and that the pretya is there, and then he can see her, and then that is who he's talking to, but that is not necessarily the case. He misses her so much, he couldn't take the shock of losing her, and now he imagines, in his imagination, he creates an illusion. In that illusion, the wife still exists, and with that wife he has these conversations. If you've never seen a mad person, most mad people are like this. What they have lost, they create in their own minds. This is the mind's self-defense mode. There's such a thing called the self-defense mode in the mind. The mind does this so that it can vent the frustration and the vexation that builds up inside. Just think about it. When you get really angry, what do you tend to do? Now don't look at me, you've never got angry. You're like, I don't know, Swami, so why don't you tell us? When you get really angry, what do you tend to do? You shout. Why do you shout? I mean, why can't you just speak in your normal voice? When you get really angry. Because if you just want to convey a message, you might as well just speak it in the normal voice, right? Why do you shout though? Here's why. When you're angry, that's a lot of vexation, that's a lot of energy that gets pent up inside. It all builds up inside, and now you want to release that energy. Because it's a lot of energy that's built up inside, it has to come out in big bouts of energy. Therefore, just a normal conversation won't do. So now it has to be in a loud voice. And it sometimes won't even stop verbally. It has to be acted out physically as well. So the reason those drawers get shut so loudly and the doors get banged is because that's all the energy that's been built up inside because of anger. If you don't let the mind to do that. You see, this is why you should have sympathy on people who get angry. Always have sympathy towards them. Their minds are weak. Their minds have a very low tolerance level. Their minds are very fragile. They're not strong. Like a little child. So towards a child, what do you have if not sympathy? In the same way, when you have to deal with someone who's really angry, and if they're screaming at you, shouting at you, one might ask, well, why should I take the abuse? I suggest to you that's not the approach you need to take. If you want to be a good Buddhist, And if you really want to apply the Dhamma that you learn here, that I teach you here, into actual real life situations, at home, at the workplace, wherever, when someone's really angry and they're screaming at you, they're really tearing you a new page. If they're not getting physical with you, right, and all you have to do is just listen to what they have to say, do it out of compassion. Because what's going on is there's a lot of energy building up. It's like a pressure cooker on the inside. Once the pressure builds up, what does the pressure cooker have to do? Release it. That's why it's got a nozzle, right? What if you seal that nozzle? What's going to happen next? It's going to blow up. So have compassion towards those who get angry. They're angry because they're weak. But they won't be weak forever, because there's something that helps the mind become strong, and that is the Dhamma. So if you have a partner, for example, a wife, a husband, whoever, who gets really angry, maybe you have a child who gets really angry, and when they're angry, all they know is to scream at you, shout at you, throw things on the floor, and they just really cause a scene at home when they get angry. Get help. If they're going to get physical, you know, start attacking you, then of course distance yourself, because there's no reason to sacrifice your health, you know, on that behalf. But if it's just something they're saying and you just have to listen to what they have to say, just out of compassion, listen to what they have to say, and then work out a way in which you can give them the Dhamma. The Dhamma helps to strengthen, to fortify the mind. It's only a weak mind that gets angry. So that's a bonus takeaway for you. But when the mind is angry, you know what the mind does. It has to release all this energy that's pent up and built up inside. The same thing happens here. This mind is expecting not just a rupa, it's expecting a pretty rupa. When it's expecting prettiness, beauty, pleasantness to come from the rupa, the mind is now in a state of expectation. But the rupa comes, no prettiness comes. Rupa comes, no beauty comes. Rupa comes, no pleasantness comes. It's just raw data. It's just a raw rupa. So what happens to the mind then? The mind has an expectation, and the expectation keeps on growing and growing and growing, and then now the mind gets really annoyed. It gets really annoyed, and at some point it's going to go crazy. What happens, ladies and gentlemen, is as the pressure builds up in the mind, remember I'm talking to you about something that happens a billion times in the flash of a second. As the pressure builds up in the mind now goes into its self-defense mode, which is to do what? To create as an illusion what it thinks is out there, because it was disappointed as it was not delivered. So the mind creates an illusion for itself. It's like a hallucination. In that hallucination, in that illusion, beauty exists. So now the mind is happy. Why is it happy? Because it just got what it asked for. Did it come from the rupa? Never came from the rupa. But the mind went into vexation, because expectation leads to vexation. What was the expectation again? That the rupa should bring with it prettiness, beauty, pleasantness. But could it? Could it? Why not? Because it's not there. How can you bring something that does not exist? When you send your little child to the shop, you know, when you're there, get some coconut and say, no, we're not out of coconuts. You know, they're going to bring back everything but the coconut. You ask the child, why didn't you bring the coconut? But the shopkeeper said they didn't have any coconuts. Is there any point in beating the child up now? Is there? No, why don't you do that? Well, if there were no coconuts, how could they bring it? I used to give this example those days when you started talking about this. Guy walks into a barber's. And he says, can I have a loaf of bread, please? What do you think he's going to walk out with? A loaf of bread? Hardly. Why not? What did he just walk into? The barbers. He should have walked into the bakers. He went into the barbers. So if you walk into the barbers, you're not going to walk out with a loaf of bread. In just the same way as if you walk into the bakers, you can't go and ask for a haircut. They don't do that, not because they don't love you, because they just can't give it to you, because they don't sell it there. In the same way, it's not that she doesn't like you. It's not that the rupa has anything against you. It's not trying to antagonize you. It's not that it has beauty but it won't give it to you unless you plead. Not so. It just doesn't have beauty. So how can it give you what it doesn't have? But the mind thinks that it's a fact that beauty is in the object. Because the mind thinks so, the mind is forever longing, yearning for beauty to be delivered to it through the eyes. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, the only reason you open your eyes is because you think there's beauty out there. Now then think about this. Every time you see beauty, what's happening in the mind? It's going insane. Every chitta that sees beauty is a chitta that has gone insane. I have proven this to you now because you know that beauty cannot exist in the object. So it has to come from somewhere. Yeah? It has to come from somewhere. You know, just think about it. You're making a cup of tea. Okay? You add the sugar. You brew your tea bag. Right? And then you put the water. You have the water in there, tea bag. You just want a plain cup of tea. You don't want milk with it. Let's just assume. And you put some sugar into it. And then you look this way and you look back and now it's a milk tea. You're going to wonder how that happened, aren't you? If you never added milk, you're going to wonder how that happened. You put the tea bag and the hot water, you let it brew for a while, you put sugar, and then you went into the living room for something, and then when you got back, there's milk in your tea. You know you didn't add it. So it must have come from somewhere. What are you going to do in this instance? If there's someone at home, what are you going to do? You're going to ask them, won't you? You're going to ask your husband, you're going to ask your children, did you put your milk into my tea? Because I didn't. In the same way, if there's no beauty in the object, but you see beauty in the final object, meaning when you perceive it, you see beauty, someone must have added beauty to it. Are you with me? If there was no beauty in the object, but in the final perception, you actually see beauty, I show you Aishwarya, and you see a beautiful Aishwarya, I never gave you a beautiful Aishwarya. I just gave you Aishwarya. But you see beautiful Aishwarya. Someone must have added the beauty into the Aishwarya. Who was that? Insane mind. That's your mind gone insane. Now who do you feel sorry for? What I've just explained to you is why and how that happens. I know until today you never questioned this. You didn't, did you? I'm not talking about the regulars. Not people who've been listening to the Dhamma for a long time. We've always seen beauty. You know, right from our younger years, when you saw a beautiful girl, you said she was beautiful. Right? When you saw something, a beautiful picture, you said it was a beautiful picture. When you saw a beautiful scenery, you said a beautiful scenery. In fact, you know, don't you remember you booked yourself on trips and you went many miles, many kilometers. Sometimes you went halfway across the globe to see beautiful sights and beautiful sceneries. Yes, remember? Who put the beauty in there? But who did you pay? Do you still have a question for me? Why, Swami Nuhan said, do you not want to go traveling? Why, Swami Nuhan said, do you not want to go and be with a beautiful woman? Do you still have that question for me? Do you have that question for why Swaminosa, do you not go sightseeing? What sights are worth seeing? If beauty, I have to add myself. If beauty is something I have to add myself, if I have to create that on my own, then why would I get on a flight and fly to the other part, other side of the world for that? Why should I go and see the Taj Mahal? Tell me. You go see the Taj Mahal because you think the Taj Mahal is beautiful. I have understood that beauty is not in the Taj Mahal. Beauty is a creation of the mind once it goes insane. It does it for its self-preservation. This is a self-defense mode. Just like the man who, if you don't give them a chance to vent their frustration, vent their anger, they're going to go mad or they're just going to collapse. Have you not seen sometimes people when they get really angry and they just can't take it anymore, they collapse. Some get a heart attack. Some get a coma. Right? So that's why I said have sympathy towards them. The last thing you want is your husband or your wife to get a heart attack, right? So if they're really angry, just let them vent it out on you. So what? You earn some merits out of it. Can't you? Can't you earn merits out of it? When you add the moral tree, did you not practice Arya Maitri? May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of desire, fire of anger, fire of frustration and so on. Well, if you can help with that process, don't you think you're going to be able to earn some merits out of it? Of course. So when someone's, you know, really gone crazy and they're angry, they're just in a fit of rage, just let it take it out on you. Just let them take it out on you. In fact, you can go in advance and say, you know, when you're angry, just come and take it out on me. I challenge you. Why not? The only caveat I'd add is, if they get physical, then move away. Because your life is not worth sacrificing for anything. Your physical health is not worth sacrificing for anything. Because you need this existence so you can attain Nibbana. Yeah? But what is being said does not hurt you unless you let your words, unless you hurt yourself. Words don't hurt. You yourself hurt. Words don't hurt. So out of compassion, just let them say whatever they want to say. So if you heed my advice, then from here on, there can only be one person at home who shouts and gets angry, and that should be the one who's not here. If you take my advice. So if the wife is here and the husband isn't here, then it's only the husband from here on who can get angry, because you don't retaliate from here on. If he's angry and he just wants to say whatever comes to his mind, let him. Just let him. You earn merits out of it. So like the mind, which when under intense pressure has to release, otherwise something terrible happens. The consequences are sometimes irreversible. In the same way, the mind also needs a self-defense mechanism. If the mind's vexation cannot be relieved by creating this hallucination, the mind will actually go mad. What is that actual madness? The madness that will take you to Angoda. So, the only reason that none of you are in the mental asylum today is thanks to your minds who have an inbuilt self-defense mechanism, and in every chitta you go just a little bit insane. That little bit of insanity keeps you from going really crazy. This is called the Abhisankara mode. You've heard of the word Abhisankara. Abhisankara is what happens in the mind once the mind starts to vex. It is building up a hallucination. It's building up this illusion, the illusion of what you want. One final thing I'll share with you today, just to once again prove what we've just discussed. Let's assume that there's someone in the audience who really likes this vatapata. Okay? And you really want this. So you're already thinking of how I can get it from Swami Nansa. Right? So maybe you might come up to me and say, Swaminasa, please can I have the Vatapatha? I'll say, come to the monastery with me and I'll give you another one. But let's say there's a child in the audience. You know, sometimes children, like when they really want something, you can't get them to stop until you give it to them. Yeah? If there's someone in the audience who really, really, really wants this Vatapatha, I propose to you that there are two ways in which I can satisfy them. Without the Dhamma. If you include the Dhamma, there are three ways. But let's ignore the Dhamma. Now there are two ways in which I can satisfy them. I'm actually trying to get across to you a very salient point here. There are two ways in which I can satisfy them. I'll give you one. See if you can give me the other one. One, give them the Vatapatha. And they are satisfied. Yes, that's the easy one, isn't it? What's the second way? Not the Dhamma, that's the third one. We discounted that. No, they just want the Vatapatha this time. They have to have the Vatapatha. So what the gentleman said was, why don't we give them something else they might like? Yeah, they'll take that and then they say, can I still have the Vatapatha? Okay, I'll help you with this. You give them something that is not the Vatapatha and convince them that it is the Vatapatha. That also works. Got it? Either you give them the Vatapatha or give them something imaginary even. Say, here puta, here. There's nothing. But just convince them that what I have just given you is the Vatapatha. If they buy your word, they will shush. Now you must wonder why Swami Nuhansa just said that to you. Yes. If you want beauty, there are two ways in which you can be satisfied. One, give you beauty. Two, let you be convinced that beauty was actually there in the object by creating a hallucination. Once you create that hallucination in your mind, you no longer need beauty to come from the outside. You've done it all by yourself. And that is how you see beauty that does not exist in the outside world. Who suffered divorce? See? That is why I no longer need a woman in my life. I no longer want to go around seeing beautiful things. Because there are no such things called beautiful things. That is why I no longer seek to please my tongue with all the foods that I used to eat when I was a prutakjana. When I had a prutakjana mindset. When I used to think like one, and I thought that deliciousness comes in food, I expected the food to deliver that to me. And you know what happened? The food never delivered that. Food gave me sweet, sour, salt, and bitter. That's all food gave me. In my mind, I created the illusion of deliciousness. That is called the insanity mode. That insanity mode saved me from actually going mad. That's why when you don't get someone have what they really want and they can't create the illusion for themselves, because you see a dead child, that's the best example really. A mother and a dead child, there is no way really, you know, a mother who's sensible, you can convince them the child is still there, right? You can't convince a mother that the child is still alive. It's impossible to convince a mother that a dead child is still alive. So therefore, there's no choice left for the mother than to go mad. Because, you see, for this to happen, to see beauty in the world, you just need to have a wrong drishti. But how can a mother who's lost her child be convinced that the child is still alive? It doesn't work, because the drishti is not compatible with her actual experience. So therefore, there is no way that you can convince a mother who's just lost her child that the child is still alive for her to create an illusion. So the illusion does not work in those instances. Abhisankara doesn't work in those instances. Then there is only one alternative. That is to go mad. Do you remember something similar happened in the Buddha's era? Who was it that went with the dead child and said, Venerable Sir, Kisa Gautami. Kisa Gautami, right? Yeah. She said, Venerable Sir, please can you heal my child? People are saying that the child is dead. Please can you heal my child? Kisa at the time was on the verge of going mad. But the Buddha, out of his compassion and knowing how the mind works, he never said, Kisa, your child is dead. Just imagine if he had said that. Kisa would not have been... She would have just gone over the threshold. And then he would not have been able to help her. So far, I have not seen anywhere in the Tripitaka where the Buddha was able to help a man who's gone mad to come back to sanity. What he was able to do is to help the insane. I make a distinction between insane, which is what we are, to mad, which is what happens when insanity mode doesn't work. Kisa was on the verge of going crazy, going mad. And so the Buddha said, okay, I'll help you. Just go and find some mustard. What the Buddha did was very tactful. He sent her off, giving her hope that this was possible, buying her some time to come to her senses. As she walked around house to house, knocking on those doors, her Miccha Ditti, in a very mundane way, this is not the supra-mundane Miccha Ditti, her Miccha Ditti in a mundane way was replaced with a mundane Samma Ditti. She began to realize that everyone dies. It's a fact of life. I must come to terms with it. But she needed time for that. And the Buddha gave her time. So then she went round and then ultimately she came back to the Buddha and said, Buddha, I have understood what you've tried to explain to me. Please save me. Please heal me. And in that moment, Kisa was saved from going mad. But now she was still insane. Insanity mode, the one that all Prithakjanas are in. And then the Buddha preached the Dhamma. And then Kisa was saved from insanity. And she came to reality. As she understood the Dhamma and attained the first stage of enlightenment, which is Sotapanna, she understood that this is how the mind works. And what she understood was, there is no such thing really called a child. All there is mind and a body. And the child is a manifestation that I project onto the child. Once she understood that, now what was there to grieve about a dead child? So she was saved. So this, what I have just explained to you today, has happened in the past as well. But sabbe prithakjana ummataka, all prithakjanas who have no understanding of the Dhamma are a little bit insane. Nothing to be proud of. So don't go around telling people, we are prithakjanas, no. There is nothing to write home about. It's an insult on yourself. If you are a prithakjana, then get yourself out of it. You suffer because of your prithakjana, the state of being a prithakjana. Fear is part of your life because of your state of prithakjana. Anger, frustration, disappointment, all of these things are part of your life because of your state of prithakjananess. Come out of it. And there's only one thing you need to do to come out of it. Understand the Dhamma. Because the Dhamma heals. The Dhamma gives you realization. The Dhamma gives you understanding. It enlightens you and opens your eyes to a wisdom that you never had. And once you realize that, The mind realizes, I'll explain the other half of this maybe in the next week, how the Dhamma fixes this problem. Because what I've explained to you today is how the problem happens. Yeah? Your expectation leads you to vexation, and that vexation builds up, and then you create this hallucination in your mind. In the next talk, I'll explain to you how the Dhamma fixes this problem. And once you've learned that, you're on your way. You're on your way. So I look forward to seeing you next week. Right, let's do a merit transfer and bring today's sermon to a close. First and foremost then, ladies and gentlemen, let us take a moment to remind ourselves how extremely fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief priests of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the, to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarik and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, husbands and wives, cousins, nephews, nieces, our elders, our friends, our acquaintances, our teachers, our employers and our employees, as well as anyone and everyone who's gone the extra mile on our behalf and spared and helped and supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our forefathers, our ancestors, our loved ones, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life that we do, as well as to practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer this message to those who have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends, acquaintances to us, those who have gone the extra mile on our behalf and helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land, and may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Thiranin Vahanse in this life itself, and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you. රාගගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා ද්වේෂගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා මෝහගින්නෙන් මිදෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතරවෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතරවෙත්වා මමද සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝ නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතරවෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතරවෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතරවෙත්වා රාගගිනි නිවේවා ද්වේෂගිනි නිවේවා මෝහගිනි නිවේවා නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා තුන්රුවන්ගේ සූවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා සාදු සාදු සාදු